all Smiley told me. I'm having a lunchtime drink with Alec in a pub a few minutes' walk from the circus. Control has given him one last chance to behave himself and put him in banking section on the ground floor, with instructions to pilfer whatever he can get his hands on, although Alec doesn't tell me this and I'm not sure he knows how much I know. It's 2:30 and we met at 1, and if you're on the ground floor you get an hour for lunch and no excuses. After a couple of pints he's into the scotch, and all he's had for lunch is a bag of crisps sprinkled with Tabasco. He has grumbled loudly about what a shitload of weirdos the circus is these days, and where are all the good guys from the war, and how the only thing the top floor cares about is kissing the American ass. And I've listened, and not said a lot because I'm not entirely sure how much is real Alec and how much he's living the part, and I'm not sure he is, which is exactly as it should be. It's only when we're out on the pavement with the traffic rolling by that he grabs my arm. For a moment I think he's going to punch me. Instead he flings his arms wide and hugs me to him like the emotional Irish drunk he's pretending to be, while tears roll down his stubbly cheeks.
I love you, hear me, Piero. And I love you, Alec, dutifully.
And before he shoves me away,
tell us, just for information, what the fuck's Wynne for?
Just a covert source we run, why?
Something that Ponce Hayden said to me in his cops the other day. Covert's got this great new source out there, and why is nobody cutting joint in on the action? Know what I told him?
What did you tell him?
If I was running covert, I said, and somebody from joint came up to me and said, who's your big source? I'd kick him in the balls.
And what did Bill say to you?
Told me to go fuck myself.
You know something else I told him?
Not yet. Keep your puffy little hands off George's wife.
It's late at night in the stables. It always is. The stables is a house that lives by night in unpredictable surges. One minute we're all bored stiff with waiting, the next there's a scuffle at the front door and a yell of shop, and in strolls Jim Prideaux with Windfall's latest batch of crown jewels. They've flown in by microdot or carbon. Jim's hand lifted them from a dead letterbox in denied territory. They've been passed to him personally by Windfall in a one-minute treff in a Prague back alley. Suddenly I'm dashing up and downstairs with telegrams. I'm crouching at my desk alerting Whitehall customers by green phone. Windfall sisters' manual typewriters are rattling away, and Ben's cipher machine is burping through the floorboards. For the next 12 hours we will be breaking up Munt's raw material, spreading it across a range of fictitious sources, a bit of signals intelligence here, a telephone or microphone intercept there, and only rarely, to keep the mix alive, the odd, highly placed and reliable informant, but all of it under the one magic name of Windfall, for indoctrinated readers only. Tonight, it's a lull between the storms. For once, George is all on his own in the middle room. I bumped into Alec a couple of days ago, I begin. I thought we had agreed you would allow your relationship with your friend Alec to cool, Peter. There's something about the Windfall operation I don't understand, and I feel I should, I say, moving into my prepared speech. Should? By what authority, my goodness me, Peter? It's just a simple question, George. I didn't know we dealt in simple questions. What's Alec's remit, that's all? To do what he's doing, as you well know. To become one of life's angry failures, a service reject. To appear resentful, vengeful, seducible, viable. With what intent, though, George, to what end? His impatience was getting the better of him. He started to answer, drew a breath, and started again. Your friend Alec Lemus is under orders to parade his well-attested character defects in all their glory, to make sure they catch the eye of the opposition's talent spotters, with a little help from the traitor or traitors in our midst, and place his considerable fund of secret intelligence on the market, for us then to add a few misleading items of our own. So a standard double-agent disinformation operation. With embellishments, yes. A standard operation. Only he seems to think he's on a mission to kill Munt.
Well, he's quite right, isn't he? He retorts, with no delay, no alteration to his tone. He was peering furiously up at me through his rounded spectacles. I had expected we would be sitting down by now, but we were still standing, and I'm substantially taller than George. But what struck me was the aridity of his voice, which reminded me of our meeting in the police house just hours after he'd struck his devil's pact with Mundt. Alec Limas is a professional, as you are, Peter, and as am I. If Control hasn't invited him to read the fine print of his mission, so much the better for Alec and for us. He can't misstep and he can't betray. If his mission succeeds in ways he has not anticipated, he will not feel deceived. He will feel he has accomplished what was required of him. But Mundt's ours, George. He's our Joe. He's Windfall. Thank you. Hans-Dieter Mundt is an agent of this service, and as such, he must be protected at all costs from those who correctly suspect him of being what he is, and dream only of putting him against a wall and taking over his job. What about Liz? Elizabeth Gold? As if he's forgotten the name, or I have mispronounced it. Elizabeth Gold will be invited to do precisely what comes naturally to her. Speak the truth and nothing but the truth. Do you now have all the information you require? No. I envy you. 12. It's another morning, a grey one for a change, and a fine rain is falling over Dolphin Square as I board my bus. As it happens, I arrive early at the stables, but Tabitha is already sitting, waiting for me, very pleased with herself for having acquired a sheaf of special branch surveillance reports, which she claims landed on her doorstep. She doesn't know whether they're authentic, of course, or whether she could ever make use of them down the line, but I mustn't on any account bubble to anyone that she's got them. All of which tells me she has a friend in special branch, and the reports are exactly what they say they are. So let's kick off with the first day of live action, this one. No hint of who actually asked Special Branch to put its dogs on to Alec, just at the request of Box. Box, I gather, being police speak for the circus in those days, yes? Yes. Do you have any idea who in Box might have placed the request to Special Branch? Joint, probably. Who particularly in Joint? Could have been any one of them. Bland, Ellaline, Esterhaz, even Hayden himself. More likely he delegated it to one of his underlings so that he didn't get his feet wet. And Special Branch to conduct the surveillance and not your dear friends in the security service. Is that normal procedure? Absolutely. Because? Because the two services didn't like each other. And our splendid police? Disliked the security service for meddling and the circus because we were a bunch of stuck-up pansies whose mission in life was to break the law. She thought about this, then about me. Frankly studying me with her sad blue eyes. You're very assured sometimes. Anyone might think you had superior knowledge. We're going to have to watch out for that. A junior official caught up in the slipstream of historic events is what we're after, not someone with a big secret to hide. Commander Special Branch to Box. Top Secret and Guard. Subject, Operation Galaxy. Prior to taking up their positions, my officers made discreet background inquiries regarding the known activities of subject couple as per their mode of employment, lifestyle, and cohabitation. Both parties are currently employed full-time at the Bayswater Library for Psychical Research, a privately funded institute managed by Miss Eleonora Crail, a single woman aged 58 of eccentric manner and appearance, not previously known to the police. Unaware that she was confiding in one of my officers, Miss Crail freely volunteered the following background information regarding the pair. Venus, whom she refers to as her darling Lizzie, has been in her full employment as an assistant librarian for the last 6 months, and in the view of Miss Crail is without blemish, being punctual, respectful, intelligent, clean in her habits, a fast and conscientious learner with good handwriting, and is well-spoken considering her class. Miss Crail has no objection to her communist views, of which she makes no secret, provided she doesn't bring them into my library. Mars, whom she calls her
nasty Mr. L, has been in her full employment as second assistant librarian pending the redesign of the library and is not, in her opinion, at all satisfactory. She has twice complained to the Bayswater Labour Exchange regarding his behaviour without result. She describes him as slovenly, discourteous, overstays his lunch hours, and frequently smells of alcoholic beverage. She resents his habit of affecting a thick Irish accent when rebuked, and she would have dismissed him after 1 week had not her darling Lizzie, Venus, interceded on his behalf, there being an unhealthy mutual attraction between the two, despite their differences in age and outlook, which in Miss Crail's opinion may already have flowered into full-on intimacy. Why else, after a mere 2 weeks of acquaintance, would they arrive simultaneously in the morning, plus on more than one occasion she has observed them holding hands, and not just because they are passing books? Asked casually by my officer what previous employment Mars had claimed, she replied that according to the employment exchange, he had been some kind of insignificant clerk in a banking house, to which she could only say that no wonder the banks were what they were coming to these days. Surveillance. For their first day of observation, my officers selected the second Friday of the month, this being the day on which the Goldhawk Road branch of the British Communist Party sponsors its open day to all shades of left-wing opinion at the Oddfellows Hall, Goldhawk Road, Venus having recently transferred her party affiliations from Cable Street to Goldhawk Road on taking up residence in Bayswater. Regular attendees include members of the Socialist Workers' Party, Militant, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, plus two undercover officers from my own force, one male, one female, thereby providing cover for toilets. On departing the library at 17:30 hours, the target couple paused at the Queen's Arms in Bayswater Street, where Mars drank a large whiskey and Venus a baby sham, arriving, as anticipated, at the Oddfellows Hall at 9:12 hours, the theme of the evening being Peace at What Price, and the hall, which accommodates 508, containing on this occasion an estimated 130 persons of varying skin colours and stations in life. Mars and Venus duly seated themselves side by side at the rear, close to the exit, with Venus, a popular figure among the comrades, receiving smiles and nods. After a short opening address by R. Palm Dutt, communist activist and journalist, who then immediately left the hall, lesser speakers took the stand, the last being Bert Arthur Lowndes, owner of Lowndes the People's Grocer, Bayswater Road, self-styled Trotskyist and well-known to the police for incitement to violence, affray, and other acts calculated to cause a breach of the peace in a public place. Until Lowndes took to the microphone, Mars had behaved in a sullen and bored manner, yawning, nodding off and periodically refreshing himself from a flask, contents unknown. The hectoring manner of Lowndes, however, roused him from his slumbers, to quote my officer, prompting him unexpectedly to raise his arm in order to catch the eye of the chairman conducting the meeting, also treasurer of the Goldhawk Road branch, Bill Flint, who duly invited Mars to state his name, then put his question to the speaker in accordance with open day rules. My officer's records of the exchange taken during and after the meeting are uniform and read as follows. Mars, Irish accent, states name. Librarian, here's a question for you, comrade. You're telling us we should lay off arming ourselves to the teeth against the Soviet threat because the Sovs aren't threatening anybody. Am I right there? Get out of the arms race now and spend the money on beer. Laughter. Lowndes. Well, that's an oversimplification if ever I heard one, comrade, but all right, if you want to put it like that, yes. Mars. Whereas, according to you, the real enemy we should be worrying about is America. American imperialism. American capitalism. American aggression. Or is that another oversimplification I'm making? Lowndes. What's your question, comrade? Mars. Well, it's this, you see, comrade. Should we not be arming ourselves to the teeth against the American threat, if they're the boys to be afraid of? Lowndes' reply drowned by laughter, angry cheers, and scattered applause. Mars and Venus exit through rear door. On the pavement, They at first appear to engage in a lively altercation. However, their differences are short-lived, and they walk arm in arm to the bus stop, pausing only to embrace. Addendum. On comparing notebooks, two of my officers separately recorded the presence of the same well-dressed 30-year-old man of medium height, wavy fair hair and effeminate appearance, who, having left the meeting directly after the pair, followed them to the bus stop and boarded the same bus, thereupon seating himself on the lower deck while the pair favoured the upper deck, enabling Mars to smoke. When the pair alighted, the same individual also alighted, and having seen them as far as their apartment building and waited until a light appeared on the third floor, he repaired forthwith to a phone box. My officers not being under instructions to pursue ancillary targets, no attempt was made to identify or house this individual. So the grand plan was working. The beasts of the forest were starting to sniff at your tethered goat, as represented by our well-dressed 30-year-old man of effeminate appearance, yes? Not my goat. Controls. Not Smiley's. When it came to planting Alec on the opposition, Smiley played second fiddle. Which was the way he wanted it? Presumably. I'm detecting a new Tabitha, or the real one, showing her claws. Had you seen this report before? Heard about it, the substance. Here in this house, together with your windfall-cleared colleagues? Yes. So, great rejoicing all round. Hurrah, they've taken the bait. Pretty much. You don't sound very sure. You weren't feeling queasy about the operation at all, you personally? Wishing you could get out of it and not seeing how? We were on course. The op was going to plan. Why should I be feeling queasy? She seemed about to question this assertion and then changed her mind. I love this one, she said, pushing another report at me. Commander Special Branch to Box, Top Secret and Guard. Subject, Operation Galaxy, Report Number 6. Unprovoked assault on Bert Arthur Lowndes, owner of Lowndes the People's Grocer, a business run on cooperative lines in the Bayswater Road, at 17:45 hours, 21st of April, 1962. The following information was taken informally from witnesses not called for trial in view of the uncontested nature of the case. Over the week preceding the incident, it appears that Mars had made a habit of calling in at Lowndes Emporium at all odd hours of day in an inebriated state, ostensibly to make a purchase on a personal monthly savings account kept in the name of Venus, to which he had access, but in reality to engage in verbal exchanges with Lowndes conducted in a loud and provocative Irish voice. On the day in question, my officer observed Mars loading up a basket with a large quantity of comestibles, including whiskey, in the approximate value of £45. On being asked whether the intended purchases were to be paid for in cash or debited to the Venus account, Mars responded with, I quote, credit you arsehole, what you effing think, plus words to the effect that being a fully paid-up member of the starving masses, he was entitled to his fair share of the world's riches. Ignoring Lowndes' warning that, the Venus account being overdrawn, no further credit was available, he thereupon advanced towards the main exit carrying the heavily laden basket of unpaid-for goods in front of him. At which point the said Lowndes advanced from behind the counter and in robust language ordered Mars to give up his basket forthwith and remove himself from the premises. Instead of which, without further argument, Mars delivered a rapid succession of blows to Lowndes' stomach and groin area, culminating in an elbow blow to the right face. Making no attempt to escape while customers screamed and Mrs. Lowndes dialed 999, Mars exhibited no remorse, but continued to pour insults on his luckless victim. As one of my younger officers afterwards remarked, he was highly grateful not to have been present at the scene, since he would have felt obligated to cast aside cover and intervene. Moreover, he frankly doubted his ability to confront the assailant single-handed. In the event, uniformed police quickly attended, and the assailant did not resist arrest. So my question is, did you personally know in advance that Alec was going to beat up poor Mr. Lowndes? In principle.
What does that mean? They wanted a moment when Alec burnt his last bridge. He'd come out of prison, be on his uppers, have no way back. They being Control and Smiley. Yes, but not you. It wasn't your own brilliant idea, cooked up by you and poached by your elders and betters. No. What worries me is that you personally might have put Alec up to it, you see. Or the other side will suggest you did. Urged your poor, broken friend to even greater depths of depravity. But you didn't, which is a relief. The same with the money Alec filched from Circus's banking section. That was six other people telling him to do it, not you. Control, I assume. Good, so Alec was trailing his coat for his superiors. You were his pal, not his evil genius. And Alec was aware of that, presumably, yes?
I assume so, yes.
So did Alec know that you were Windfall cleared? Of course he bloody didn't. How could he? He didn't know anything about Windfall.
Yes, well, I was afraid you'd be indignant. I'm going off to do some homework, if you don't mind, while you browse through this horror. The English translation is dire, but so, I'm told, is the original text. Makes one long for Special Branch's magic way with words.
Extracts from hitherto unreleased Stasi files marked not to be released till 2050 as excerpted and translated by Zara N. Potter Associates, court-approved interpreters and translators as commissioned by Messrs. Seagrove, Love and Barnabas, solicitors at law, London, W.C.
As the door closed after her, I was seized by an irrational anger. Where had she gone, damn her? Why did she walk out on me like that? To render a breathless account to her pals in the Bastion, is that the game she's playing? They hand her a bunch of Special Branch reports and say, try these on him for size. Is that how it works? But that wasn't how it worked. I knew that. Tabitha was every defendant's good angel, and her soft, sad eyes saw a sight further than Bunny's or Laura's. I knew that too. Alec is propped against the grimy window, peering out. I'm sitting in the only armchair. We are in an upstairs bedroom of a commercial hotel in Paddington that lets out rooms by the hour. This morning he called me on an unlisted line at Marylebone reserved for Joe's. Meet me at the Duchess, 6 o'clock. The Duchess of Albany, Praed Street, one of his old haunts. He is haggard, red-eyed and twitchy. The glass in his drinking hand trembles. Short, grudging sentences, bitten out between pauses. There's this girl, he is saying, bloody communist. Can't blame her. Not where she comes from. Anyway, who blames who for what anymore? Wait. Don't ask. He'll tell you what he wants. I told Control, keep her out of it. I don't trust the old bastard. Never know what he's up to. Wonder whether he does himself.
Long contemplation of street below. Continued sympathetic silence from me.
Anyway, where the fuck's George hiding?
Swinging round on me accusingly.
I had a treff with Control in Bywater Street the other night. George didn't bloody show up.
George is doing a lot of Berlin just now, I say untruthfully. And again I wait. Alec has decided to mimic Control's donnish bray.
I want you to get rid of Munt for me, Alec. Make the world a better place. Are you up for that, old man?
Of course I'm bloody up for it. Bastard killed Remek, didn't he? Killed half my bloody network. Had a go at George too a year or two back. Can't have that, can we, Piero?
No, we can't, I agree heartily. Did he catch a false note in my voice? He takes a pull of scotch and goes on staring at me.
You don't happen to have met her by any chance, Piero?
Met who?
My girl. You know bloody well who I mean.
How the hell could I have met her, Alec? What are you bleating on about? Jesus, man. He turns away at last.
Someone she'd met, a man, sounded a bit like you, that's all.
I shake my head in mystification, shrug, smile.
Alec goes back to his contemplations, peering down at the passers-by on the pavement as they scurry through the rain. Subject: false accusations made against Comrade Hans-Dieter Mundt by fascist British intelligence agents. Full, total and complete exoneration of H.D. Mundt by People's Tribunal. Liquidation of imperialist spies while attempting to escape, submitted to said presidium. 28th of October, 1962. If the Star Chamber that sat in judgment over Hans-Dieter Mundt was a travesty, the official account of it was worse. The prologue might have been written by Mundt himself. Perhaps it was. The odious and corrupt counter-revolutionary agitator Limas was a known degenerate, a drunken bourgeois opportunist, liar, womanizer, thug, obsessed by money and a hatred of progress. The devoted Stasi operatives who had procured the false testimony of this evil Judas had done so in good faith and could not be blamed for introducing a viper into the heartland of those dedicated to combating the forces of fascist imperialism. The trial was a triumph of socialist justice and a call for ever greater vigilance against the intrigues of capitalist spies and provocateurs. The woman who called herself Elizabeth Gold was a political simpleton of pro-Israel sympathies, brainwashed by the British Secret Service, besotted by her older lover, and lured wide-eyed into a web of Western intrigue. Even after the imposter Limas had made a full confession of his crimes, the woman Gold had treacherously assisted him in his escape and paid the full price for her duplicity. And a closing word of congratulation to that fearless guardian of democratic socialism who didn't hesitate to shoot her down as she made her escape. So, Peter, a quick replay of the truly awful kangaroo trial in plain English. Are we up for that? Whatever. But her voice was brisk and purposeful, and she had plonked herself down directly in front of me, across the table like a people's commissar. Alec arrives in the Star Chamber as Fiedler's prize witness with best-laid plans to dish the dirt on Mundt, yes? Fiedler tells the court all about the bogus money trail that leads to Mundt's front door, yes? He makes a whole mouthful of Mundt's time as a pseudo-diplomat in England, which, according to Fiedler, was when he was picked up and turned by the forces of reactionary imperialism, alias the circus. Then we have a list of all the shocking state secrets Mundt has allegedly sold to his Western masters for his 30 pieces of silver, and it's all going down a storm with the tribunal's judges until what? The sweet smile is long gone. Until Liz, I suppose, I reply grudgingly. Until Liz, indeed. Up pops poor Liz, and because she doesn't know any better, she puts the kibosh on everything her beloved Alec has just told the court. Did you know she was going to do that? Of course I didn't. How the devil could I? How could you indeed? And did you notice by any chance what actually sank Liz and her Alec? It was the moment when she brought up George Smiley's name. Her absolutely innocent admission to the Star Chamber that one George Smiley, accompanied by a younger man, had dropped in to see her soon after Alec's mysterious disappearance and told her that her Alec was doing a marvellous job, implicitly for his country, and everything was going to be hunky-dory. Your George then left his visiting card with her to make sure she didn't forget. Smiley being, anyway, a name effortlessly remembered and by no means unknown to the Stasi. Such an inept thing to do, don't you think, for a sly old fox like George? I said something to the effect that even George could slip up now and then. And were you the younger man who tagged along with him by any chance? No, I wasn't. How could I be? I was Marcel, remember? So who was it? Jim, probably. Preda. He'd come across. Across? From joint to covert. And was also windfall cleared? I believe so. Only believe. He was cleared. Then tell me this, if you're allowed to. When Alec Limas was sent off on his mission to shaft Mundt at any price, Who did he believe was the anonymous source who was providing the circus with all its lovely windfall material? No idea. Never discussed it with him. Probably controlled it. Dunno. Let me put it another way, if it's simpler. Would it be fair to say, on balance, by inference, by a process of elimination, by certain hints half-dropped, that by the time Alec Limas sets out on his fatal voyage, he has taken it into his fuddled head that Joseph Fiedler is the vital source he is protecting, which is why the odious Hans-Dieter Mundt has to be eliminated? I heard my voice rise, and couldn't stop it. How the hell am I supposed to know what Alec thought or didn't think? Alec was a fieldman. You don't think round corners if you're a fieldman. There's a cold war on, you've got a job to do, you get on with it. Was I talking about Alec? Or myself? So help me solve this knotty little conundrum, if you will. You, P. Gwillem, were windfall cleared, yes? One of the very, very few. Can I go on? I can. Alec was emphatically not so cleared. He knew there was an East German supersource, or bunch of sources, with the generic name Windfall. He knew Covert had the running of him, her, or them. But he didn't know anything about this place we're sitting in now, or what it was actually up to, true? I suppose so. And it was vital that he should not be Windfall cleared, which has been your refrain from the outset. So, in my dead, weary voice. Well, if you were windfall cleared and Alec Limas wasn't windfall cleared, what did you know that Alec wasn't allowed to know? Or are we exercising our right to silence? I wouldn't recommend it. Not with the all-party lot waiting to tear into you. Or when you're sitting in front of a tame jury. This is what Alec went through, I'm thinking. Defending a hopeless case and watching it fall apart in his hands, with the difference that nobody's dying except of old age. I'm clinging for dear life to a great untenable lie I promised I'd never betray, and it's sinking under my weight. But Tabitha has no mercy. So our feelings, can we talk about them for a change? So much more illuminating than facts, I always think. What did you feel? You yourself, when you heard that poor Liz suddenly stood up and trashed all Alec's marvellous hard work, trashed poor Fiedler too while she was about it. I didn't hear. I'm sorry? Nobody picked up the phone and said, heard the latest about the trial. First thing we got was an East German news flash. Traitor unmasked. That was Fiedler down the drain. Senior security official totally exonerated. That was Mundt in the clover. Then we got the prisoners' dramatic escape and a nationwide hunt for them, and then we got the shootings at the wall, presumably. George was there, George saw it, I didn't. And your feelings again, as you sat here in this very room, or stood here, paced, or whatever you did, and the awful news came trickling through in bits and pieces. Now hear this, now hear that, on and on. What do you think I bloody did? Whistled up the champagne? Pause while I collect myself. I thought, Jesus God, that poor girl, caught up in it all. Refugee family. Head over heels in love with Alec. Meant no harm to anyone. What a bloody awful thing to have to do. Have to? You mean she intended to appear before the tribunal? She intended to save the Nazi and kill the Jew? That doesn't sound like Liz at all. Whoever would have told her to do a thing like that? Nobody bloody told her. The poor girl didn't even know why she was at the trial. She'd been invited to a comrades' jamboree in the sunny GDR, and all of a sudden she's testifying against her lover in a kangaroo court. How did you feel when you heard that? You, personally. Then to hear they'd both been mown down at the wall, shot while escaping, allegedly. Anguish it must have been, utter, surely. Of course it was. For all of you? All. Control too? Not an expert on Control's feelings, I'm afraid. That sad smile of hers, it's come back.
And your Uncle George?
What about him?
Just how did he take it?
I don't know.
Why not?
Sharply. He disappeared. Took himself down to Cornwall alone.
Why?
To walk, I assume. It's where he goes.
For how long?
A few days, maybe a week. And when he came back, was he an altered man?
George doesn't alter, he just gets his composure back. And he did?
He didn't talk about it. She thought about this. Seemed reluctant to let the subject go.
And no little smidgen of triumph anywhere, she resumed after further thought. On the other front, the operational front. No sense anywhere of, well, that was the collateral damage. It's tragic and it's awful, but mission accomplished nonetheless. Nothing of that kind, as far as we're aware.
Nothing has changed. Not her gentle voice, not her creamy smile. Her manner, if anything, even kindlier than before.
What I'm asking you is, when did you know, in your own mind, that Munt's triumphant vindication was not the fuck-up it was made out to be, but a grand-scale intelligence coup in disguise, and that Liz Gold was the necessary catalyst that made it all happen?
It's about your defense, you see, your intent, your foreknowledge, your complicity. You could stand or fall by any one of them.
A silence for the dead, broken by Tabitha in a voice of casual inquiry.
You know what I dreamed last night?
Why the hell should I?
I was doing my due diligence, wading through that endless draft report that Smiley made you write and decided not to circulate. And I got to wondering about that peculiar Swiss ornithologist who turned out to be an undercover member of the circus's domestic security arm. And then I asked myself, why didn't Smiley want your report circulated? So I did some more due diligence and nosed around wherever I was allowed to nose, and for the life of me I couldn't turn up a single thing about anybody testing the defences of Camp 4 over that period. And absolutely nothing about an overzealous undercover operator who punched out Camp 4's security guards. So it didn't exactly take an epiphany to stitch together the rest. No death certificate for Tulip?
Well, we know the poor girl hadn't landed officially, but not many doctors like putting their names to a bogus death certificate, even circus doctors.
I glowered into the distance and tried to pretend I thought she was mad.
So my reading is, Munt was sent over to murder Tulip. He murdered her, but the good Lord wasn't on his side and he got caught. George put the hard word on him, spy for us or else. He does. Cornucopia of lovely intelligence, suddenly at risk. Fiedler looks like rumbling him. Enter control with his revolting plan. George may not have cared for it, but as ever with George, duty called. Nobody reckoned on Liz and Alec getting shot. That would have been Munt's big idea. Shoot the messengers and get a better night's sleep. Not even control could have spotted that one on the horizon. Your George went straight into retirement, vowing never to spy again. Which we love him for, although it didn't last. He still had to come back and catch Bill Hayden, which he did wonderfully well, bless him. And you were for him all the way, which we can only applaud.
Nothing came to mind, so I said nothing.
And to twist the knife in what was already a very large wound, no sooner had the Star Chamber done its business than Hans Dieter was summoned to a power conference in Moscow, never to be seen again. So goodbye to any last hopes that he might get his nose under the wire at centre and tell us who the circus traitor was. Presumably Bill Hayden had got there ahead of him.
Can we talk a little more about you?
I couldn't stop her, so why try?
If I was allowed to argue that Windfall was not the cock-up of all time, but a fiendishly clever operation that was wildly productive of top-grade intelligence, and only went off the rails at the last minute, I have very little doubt that the all-party-goers would roll over and put their paws in the air. Liz and Alec? Tragic, yes, but in the circumstances, acceptable losses in the cause of the greater good. Am I winning?
I'm not, oh dear. Only suggesting. Because I don't think I can defend you any other way. In fact, I'm quite sure I can't. She had started to pack her things together. Spectacles, cardigan, paper tissues, special branch reports, Stasi reports.
You spoke, Hart?
Did I? Neither of us is sure. She's called a halt to her packing. She's holding her briefcase open on her lap, waiting for me to speak. Eternity ring on second finger. Odd, I haven't noticed it till now. Wonder who the husband is. Probably dead. Look here.
Still looking, Hart?
Accepting for one moment your absurd hypothesis that the fiendishly clever operation worked. Accepting it theoretically, which I absolutely do not. Are you seriously telling me that in the impossible event that documentary proof to that effect should ever come to light, which we know it won't, but if it ever did, it would have to be cast iron. Are you telling me that in such an improbable eventuality, the charges, the accusations, litigation, the whole bang shooting match against whomever, me, George, if he can be found, even the service, would go away? You find me the evidence, I'll find you the judge. The vultures are gathering as we speak. If you don't show up for the hearing, the all-party goers will fear the worst and act accordingly. I asked Bunny for your passport. The brute won't part with it. But he will extend your stay at Dolphin Square on the same miserly terms, all to be discussed. Will same time tomorrow morning suit you? Could we make it 10? I'll be on the dot, she replied. And I said I would too.
13. When the truth catches up with you, don't be a hero. Run. But I took care to walk slowly into Dolphin Square and up to the safe flat I knew I would never sleep in again. Draw curtains, sigh resignedly for the television set, close bedroom door. Extract French passport from dead letterbox behind fire precautions notice. There is a calming ritual to escape. Don clean set of clothes. Shove razor in raincoat pocket. Leave the rest in place. Make my way down to grill room, order light meal, settle to my boring book like a man reconciled to a solitary evening. Chat up Hungarian waitress in case she has reporting responsibility. Actually, I live in France, I tell her, but I'm over here to talk business with a bunch of English lawyers. Can she imagine anything worse? Ha ha. Pay bill. Saunter into courtyard with retired ladies in white hats and croquet skirts seated in pairs along garden benches. Enjoy the unseasonable sunshine. Prepare to join Exodus to embankment, never to return. Except that I do neither of these last two things, because by now I have spotted Christoph, son of Alec, in his long black coat and Homburg hat, lounging 20 yards away on a bench all to himself, with one arm thrown affectionately along the back of it, and one large leg slung over the other for leisure, and his right hand buried, ostentatiously to my eye, in his overcoat pocket. He is staring straight at me, and he is smiling, which is not something I've seen him do before, whether as a child watching a football match or as a man eating steak and chips. And perhaps the smile is new to him too, because it comes with a peculiar whiteness in the face, intensified by the blackness of his hat, and there is a flicker to his smile like a faulty light bulb that doesn't know whether it's on or off. And I am as much at a loss as he appears to be. A tiredness has come over me which I suspect is fear. Ignore him. Give him a cheery wave and continue with my planned escape. He will come after me. He will raise a hue and cry. He's got a plan too, but what is it? The sickly pale smile continues to flicker. There is something about his lower jaw, an irritation he seems unable to control,
Has he actually broken his right arm? Is that why it's jammed so awkwardly in his coat pocket? He makes no effort to get up. I set out towards him, closely observed by the seated ladies in white hats. In the whole courtyard, we are the only two males, and Christoph cuts an eccentric, not to say gargantuan, figure, occupying a whole stage to himself. What is my business with him? They are wondering. So am I. I come to a halt in front of him. Nothing of him moves. He could be one of those bronze statues of great men you see seated in public places, a Churchill, a Roosevelt. The same moist complexion, the same unconvincing smile. The statue comes slowly to life in a way that other statues don't. He uncrosses his legs. Then, with his right shoulder high and his right hand still jammed in his overcoat pocket, shuffles his big body until there is space on the bench for me at his left side. And yes, he is sickly pale and agitated around the jaw, now smiling, now grimacing, and his gaze is feverish. "Who told you where to find me, Christoph?" I ask him as cheerfully as I may, because by now I'm grappling with the far-fetched notion that Bunny, or Laura, or even Tabitha, has put him on to me, with the aim of negotiating some other kind of underhand deal between the service and its litigants. I remembered, the smile widening with dreamy pride. "I'm a memory genius, okay? The brain of fucking Germany, so we have our nice meal, and you tell me to go fuck myself. Okay, you didn't tell me, I go away. I sit down with my friends, I smoke a little, I snort a little, I listen. Who do I hear, wanna guess?" I shake my head. I'm smiling, too. "My daddy, I hear my daddy. His voice. On one of our little walks together around the prison courtyard. I'm doing time, he's trying to play catch-up, be the ever-faithful father he never was. So he's talking about himself, entertaining me, telling me about the years we didn't spend together, like pretending we did. What it was like to be a spook, how special you all were, how dedicated, such naughty boys you were. And you know what? He's talking about Hood House, the House of Hoods, this joke you all had, how the circus owned these crappy safe flats in a place called Hood House. We're all hoods, so that's where they put us." The smile becomes a scowl of indignation. "You know your shit service has even got you registered here under your own name, for fuck's sake. P. Gwillem. How's that for security? Did you know that?" he demanded. No, I didn't know. Neither was I marveling, as I should have done, that in more than half a century the service hadn't thought to change its habits. "So why don't you tell me what you've come for?" I asked him, unsettled by his smile, which he seemed unable to shake off. "To kill you, Piero," he explained, with no lift or variation to his voice. "To shoot your fucking head off. Bingo, you're dead." "Here?" I ask. "In front of all these people?" "How?" "With a Walther P-38 semi-automatic pistol. The one he has drawn from the right-hand pocket of his overcoat and is now brandishing in plain sight. And only after plenty of time for me to admire it does he restore it to his overcoat pocket while keeping his hand on it and, in the best tradition of gangster movies, pointing the barrel at me through the folds of his coat. What the ladies in white hats make of this display, if anything at all, I shall never know. Perhaps we're a film unit. Perhaps we're just silly grown-up boys playing a game with a toy gun." "Good gracious me," I exclaim. A term I've never consciously used in my life until now. "Wherever did you get that from?" The question annoyed him, extinguishing the smile. "You think I don't know wise guys in this fucking town? People who will lend me a gun like that, he demanded, flicking the thumb and forefinger of his free hand in my face. Prompted by the word lend, I peered instinctively round for the rightful owner, since I was not imagining a long-term loan. Which was how my eye came to settle on a Volvo saloon repaired in various colours and parked on a double yellow line directly opposite the archway on the embankment side, and its one bald male driver with both hands on the wheel, staring hard ahead of him through the windscreen. "Do you have a particular reason for killing me, Christoph?" I asked him, maintaining as best I could the same note of casual inquiry. "I've told the powers that be of your offer, if that's what you're worried about," I threw in mendaciously. "They're thinking about it. Her Majesty's bean counters don't cough up €1 million overnight, naturally."
"I was the best thing in his lousy, rotten life, he told me that," spoken in a low tone, forced from between rigid teeth. "I never doubted that he loved you," I said. "You killed him. You lied to my dad and you killed him. Your friend. My dad." "Christoph, that's not true. Your dad and Liz Gold weren't killed by me or anyone else in the circus. They were killed by Hans-Dieter Mundt of the Stasi."
"You're all sick, all you spies. You're not the cure, you're the fucking disease. Jerk-off artists playing jerk-off games, thinking you're the biggest fucking wise guys in the universe. You're nothings, hear me? You live in the fucking dark because you can't handle the fucking daylight. Him too, he told me that."
"He did? When?"
"In prison, where the fuck do you think? My first prison. Kids' prison, pervs, cokeheads, and me. Somebody to see you, Christoph, says he's your best pal. They cuff me and take me to him. It's my dad. 'Hear this,' he says. 'You're a lost cause, and there's fuck all that I or anybody else can do for you anymore. But Alec Lemus loves his son, so don't fucking forget it. You speak?' 'No.' 'Stand the fuck up. Walk. That way. Through the archway. Like the rest of the people. You fuck with me, I kill you.' I stand up. I walk towards the archway. He follows me, his right hand still in his pocket and the gun pointed at me through the cloth. There are things you're supposed to do in these cases, like wheel round and catch him with your elbow before he's time to fire. We rehearsed it with water pistols at Sarat, and more often than not, the water squirted past you onto the gym mat. But this isn't a water pistol, and it isn't Sarat. Christos walking 4 feet behind me, which is where the well-taught gunman should be. We have passed through the archway. The bald man sitting in the multicolored Volvo still has his hands on the steering wheel, and although we're walking straight towards him, he pays us no attention. He's too busy staring ahead. Does Christoph intend to take me for the proverbial ride before he puts me out of my misery? If he does, my best chance of breaking free will come when he tries to get me into the Volvo. I've done that once long ago. Broken a man's hand for him with the car door when he was trying to get me to climb into the back seat. Other cars are passing in both directions and we have to wait for a gap in the traffic before we cross the road. And I'm wondering whether I'll get the chance to grapple with him and in the worst case shove him at an oncoming car. We've reached the opposite pavement and I'm still wondering. We've also walked past the Volvo without a sign or word passing between Christoph and its bald driver, so maybe I've got it wrong and they're nothing to do with each other, and whoever lent Christoph the Walther is sitting in Hackney or somewhere playing a game of cards with his fellow wise guys. We're standing on the embankment and there's a brick parapet about 5 feet high and I'm standing facing it with the river in front of me and the lights of Lambeth on the other bank because it's dusk already, still mild for the time of day, a nice breeze coming up and quite big boats gliding by and I have my hands on the parapet and my back to him and I'm hoping that he'll come close enough for me to try the water pistol trick, but I can't feel his presence and he's not talking. Keeping my hands wide where he can see them, I turn slowly round and he's standing 6 feet away from me, still with his hand in his pocket. He's breathing in gulps and his big, pale face is moist and luminous in the half-light.
People pass us by, but they don't pass between us. Something about us tells them to step around us. More accurately, it's something about Christoph's bulk, overcoat and Homburg hat. Is he brandishing the gun again, or is it in his pocket? Is he still adopting his gangster posture? It occurs to me late in the day that the man who dresses like that wants to be feared, and the man who wants to be feared is afraid himself. And perhaps this is what gives me the bravado to challenge him. Come on, Christoph, do it, I say, as a middle-aged couple scurry past. Shoot me if it's what you've come for. What's another year to a man of my age? I'll settle for a good, clean death any time. Shoot me. Then spend the rest of your life congratulating yourself while you rot in jail. You've seen old men die in prison. Be another. By now the muscles in my back are squirming and there's a pulse beating in my ears, and I couldn't have told you whether it came from a passing barge or was something going on inside my own head. My mouth had gone dry from all the speaking and my gaze must have missed it over because it took me a while to acknowledge that Christoph was beside me, slouched over the parapet, retching and sobbing in gulps of pain and anger. I put an arm across his back and eased his right hand free of his pocket. When it came out with no gun in it, I drew out the gun for him and slung it as far as I could into the river, but heard nothing in reply. He had his arms on the parapet and had sunk his head into them. I fished around in his other pocket, on the off chance that he'd provided himself with a spare magazine to embolden him, and sure enough he had. I'd just thrown that into the river too when the bald man from the multicoloured Volvo, who by contrast with Christoph was very small and looked half-starved, seized him by the waist from behind and hauled at him, to no effect. Between us we prized him away from the parapet and between us we manhandled him as far as the Volvo. As we did so, he began to howl. I made to open the passenger door, but my companion in arms had already opened the back door. Between us we bundled him in and slammed the door after him, damping but not silencing the howls. The Volvo drove away. I stood alone on the pavement. Slowly the traffic and the sounds returned. I was alive. I hailed a cab and asked the driver to take me to the British Museum. First the cobbled alley, then the private car park that stank of rotting rubbish, then the 6 kissing gates. Ours was the end one on the right. If Christoph's howls were still ringing in my head, I refused to hear them. The fastener on the gate squeaked. I heard that all right. It always had done, however many times we oiled it. If we knew control was coming, we'd leave the gate open so we wouldn't have to listen to the old devil's sour comment about being heralded by the clashing of cymbals. Slabs of York stone. Mendel and I had laid them, and sowed grass between. Our birdhouse. No bird turned away. 3 steps to the kitchen door and Millie McCraig's motionless shadow looking down on me through the window, holding her hand up, forbidding me to enter. We stand in an improvised garden shed, built against the wall to shelter her dustbins and the remnants of her lady's upright bicycle, exiled from the house by Laura, draped in a tarpaulin and stripped of its wheels for security. We are speaking in murmurs. Perhaps we always did. The classified cat watches from the kitchen window. I don't know what they've put where, Peter, she confides. I don't trust my telephone. Well, I never did. I don't trust my walls either. I don't know what they've got these days, nor where they put it. You heard what Tabitha said to me about evidence. Part I did, enough. Have you still got everything we gave you? The original statements, correspondence, whatever else George asked you to hide away? Microdotted by myself, cached. I have 2. Where? In my garden, in my birdhouse, in their cassettes, in oilskins, in that. That being the remnants of her bicycle,
They don't know where to look these days, Peter. They've no proper training, she adds indignantly. Including George's interview with Windfall at Camp 4.